Welcome, everyone. We're so glad that you're joining us today, and I am excited to introduce our next guest, Carrie Bennett, who is an educator and clinician in the emerging field of quantum biology, or the application of applied quantum biology. Her work examines how the body operates at the quantum scale, which has just been something that I've been incredibly passionate about for, you know, decades. And so when I first got exposed to your work, Carrie, I just was over the moon because I felt like I'd found a comrade, and I so appreciate your kind of clear thinking and just your ability to articulate very complex concepts to people in a way that they can understand. And then better yet, you found ways in which they can adjust their lifestyle to kind of apply these concepts to their life, try them on for size and see how it changes how they feel. So anyway, welcome, Carrie, and so excited to have you.
Oh, thank you, Beth. I'm thrilled to chat with you. This, as I'm sure you can imagine, it's so nice speaking to someone who kind of gets the body from this angle, and I'm thrilled to share this information with everyone.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, one of the things that you talk a lot about, and it's such a cool topic, is how light contains information. And I fully agree with that. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how the different wavelengths of light and, you know, communicate differently to the body and how we're affected by the light.
Sure. You know, that's a great question. And it wasn't until about 10 years ago that I myself started recognizing light as almost like a nutrient. You know, it contains valuable stuff for the human body. And so to break it down in its most basic way, we recognize everyone has seen light in its colors, either through a rainbow or through a prism. And so, you know, that light that we would see from the sun, it's not just this invisible entity, right? We can actually divide it up and see the different colors it contains. And it only makes sense that through, you know, the human body's experience and evolution with light, that we would have kind of gathered some information from that light. And it turns out we do, right? We actually can absorb the wavelengths of different colors of light, from the ones that we see in the visible spectrum of the rainbow to the ones that we also don't see that they're considered, you know, not visible to the human eye, the infrared portion and the ultraviolet light. Turns out that those wavelengths interact with our body beyond our vision. And I do believe that the non-visual interaction we have with light far exceeds it's the importance in our bodies and what we can actually just see and visualize. So the way that light interacts with different sensors or receptors in our body gives us information to do different tasks throughout the day. And because light varies, or light from the sun, right? Light in nature varies all day long in terms of its blend of colors and how bright it is. All of those are signals that the body has used to key into to be able to say, oh, it's morning, I need to be doing X, Y, and Z. Oh, it's nighttime, there is no light, it's darkness. Now we need to switch to new tasks. And so if we sync our body up to the light cycle and recognize especially key times of day that I found in clinical practice to be most impactful, then we can actually really optimize a lot of signaling pathways in the body.
Absolutely. And I love what you said about light as a nutrient. And just like vitamin C has one effect in the body and vitamin D has another, the different wavelengths of light do very specific things in the body. You know, infrared is different than red and ultraviolet. And so maybe you could speak a little bit to, I love also what you're saying, you know, about the blending of these different wavelengths at different times of the day is really what kind of connects us into the circadian rhythm and affects the circadian rhythm nature of our biology. But maybe you could speak to both individual wavelengths of light and their specific actions that we know of thus far, and our circadian biology.
Absolutely. And I'd love to preface this by saying we probably know less than 1%, right, of what all these wavelengths do. But what we do know, it's inspiring to me, you know, to get more light, to be connected to that light. And so before the sun rises, you know, I'm a nerd, right, Beth? And I get my little meter called a spectrometer out, and I measure the colors of light. You can literally see like a report of the different colors of light and their ratios to each other at given times of day. So I'll take this little spectrometer out, and before sunrise, it's really dominated by red and infrared wavelengths. The other colors are much muter, much less powerful at that time. And so for all intents and purposes, this makes perfect sense to me, because red and infrared are now harnessed in photobiomodulation devices or red light therapy devices. But what we can get from nature is the fact that red light will help to improve mitochondrial energy production. So it can increase it's called mitochondrial membrane potential, right? You're going to increase mitochondrial efficiency. It's also going to help the mitochondria make more water, which happens at step 4 of the electron transport chain. It's very soothing light, so it's calming to the nervous system, but it kind of revs up the body's energy production powerhouses in the cells, right? So we get that kind of start to our day. And then as soon as the sun crosses the horizon, and this happens whether we physically see the sun crossing the horizon or whether it's behind a tree or behind a mountain or behind a house or a building. Simply being outside at that time of day, if you take that meter out, you'd see a large increase in blue light. So now we've got blue balanced with red and infrared. They're kind of at the same blend. That kicks off our circadian rhythm. That blue light starts to get picked up by our blue light sensors called melanopsin receptors in the backs of our eyes, which then kind of wakes up the hypothalamus and all the things the hypothalamus is in control of in the morning, from the HPA axis to the hypothalamus pituitary thyroid axis to the ovarian axis. So the light that enters our eyes basically starts our circadian clock and then all of the hormonal cascades that go with it.
Right. I actually will share with everyone that one of my favorite practices that I personally do is wake up in the morning and I meditate. And when I sense the sun is about to crest the horizon, then I go outside, take my socks off. I'm out bare feet on the ground. Luckily, I'm in California. Sometimes it's in the 40s, but I spend a good 10 minutes outside in the morning. And since I've been doing that for quite some time now, it's changed so much about my health, like so much about how well I sleep at night, how much deep sleep I get at night, how much energy I have in the day, my mood, et cetera. Maybe you could speak to some applications of this.
Yeah, absolutely. That is one key chunk of time that I really encourage clients to get if they can. It's just, I call it a little hit of sunrise into their eyes. So sunrise eyes. And what, because of the fact that when we get out there, we do get this circadian surge of cortisol. And cortisol gets a bad rep, right? It's the stress hormone. It's bad all the time. No, that's not true. We need a surge of cortisol in the morning in order to kind of rev us up, get our blood sugar optimized, or just get our body going. Before that cortisol gets made, pregnenolone gets made in the mitochondria, which is the master steroid hormone that becomes cortisol, but it also becomes estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, DHEA, all of these other very important steroid hormones that the body uses, like you said, to optimize energy production, metabolism, mood, you name it. And so a little circadian practice of sunrise eyes grounded with intention, I always love to throw that out there. It's like, sky gaze east to the brightest part of the sky with your bare skin touching the earth and set an intention for the day. It is such a simple but powerful practice. And then I find like if there's another time of day for people to go outside, it's a little bit later in the morning. And I call this your UVA rise. It's when ultraviolet A appears, right? So there's no UV light in the morning at all until the sun gets to 10 degrees above the horizon. And that's the point when ultraviolet A can penetrate into your space, right, into your location. And that is what I call the time of neurotransmitter magic, because it really starts to balance the production of serotonin, dopamine, adrenaline, noradrenaline, even thyroid hormone production, simply based on the ultraviolet A light entering our eyes. And so it's another key window. It's a beautiful time to take either a mid-morning break and go for a walk, or what I tell clients to get a light break, like always see if you can time a light break. And that time of day seems to be even more powerful for mood boosting, pain reduction, improving sleep that following night, energy, you name it. It's another key window. And we're not talking about hours, right? It's like 10 minutes, a 10-minute practice, again, of just getting these key signals into your eyes that sets this whole cascade off of chemistry and biology, or chemistry and hormones and other physiological processes in the body. But it's timed to the light. And that's been a missing factor in so many of our, you know, lifestyles these days.
I love that. And it's just, when you think about the fact that we used to live outside, you know, we used to be under the light and fully connected with the shifting terrain of kind of frequency blend throughout the entire day. And now in this modern day, you know, we have to find ways to recapitulate that to, you know, to what it, to the degree that it fits in with our life. And I think that is just such a phenomenal piece of advice, to just even take 10 minutes in the mid-morning and go outside. And that's not something I've been recommending to people. I think it's a really important thing to include, because I'm gonna try that one on for size. I have to kind of book myself out, you know, in the middle of my patient morning, but I think I'm gonna do it.
You know, it's typically when I take a phone call or something like that, where I can, you know, just have my headphones on and be outside talking on a call where I don't have to be face to face in front of someone in front of the computer. But I would love to hear your clinical experience, because it is for me, it's by far the most impactful time of day for all of my clients. They become addicted to it. There's also actually that, but I didn't even talk about that, right? But there's a chemical in the brain called POMC in response to that UVA light. That POMC can kind of get cut different ways, and it's going to get cut into beta endorphin, a runner's high. Mm-hmm. So like these clients actually start to get addicted to light at that time, because they feel so good being out there within that early morning UVA light.
Wow, I love it. It's so cool. And then now, okay, you are, first of all, I want to give you kudos to you. I have to say, it's always so exciting when I learn something new, you know, like it's like something that I hadn't thought about before, whatever. And there, I'm going to credit you with something so cool, which is the pregnenolone first step from cholesterol as its building block happens in the mitochondria. And I completely agree with you. I'm always trying to augment kind of steroid biosynthesis pathways, and pregnenolone is the key kind of grandmother steroid from which DHEA is made, and then testosterone and estradiol and progesterone and cortisol. And I phenomenally agree with you that cortisol is not bad. It's been so maligned, and it's of course not good to have too much, but I spend most of my day helping people that don't have enough. You know, they have allergies, they have autoimmunity, they have fatigue and exertional worsening fatigue. They're flipping into adrenaline modes. They can't sleep well at night. They can't keep their blood sugar balanced, like you name it. Anyway, maybe you could talk just a little bit about now the mitochondria, and just this is like my favorite little organelle, and all that it's doing in relationship to light exposure. That's the cool interface that I'd love for you to focus on.
Absolutely. It's really such a cool thing to understand when then you realize, oh, the light impacts the mitochondria so much. Because mitochondria is another buzzword, right? I do believe mitochondrial dysfunction is behind a lot of what we would consider classic Western diagnoses these days of disease. And so to recognize that the mitochondria are in tune with the light is so key. So mitochondria are really, I believe that they're sensors inside of ourselves. And it makes sense, because one of the main, I guess, most supported theories of their origin was that they were bacterial in origin, which is pretty evident because they have their own circular DNA. So they used to be bacteria. And what would they have had to do as their own unique species of bacteria? They would have to be very aware of what's going on in their environment. So they've got this, essentially this sixth sense, right? Where they know what time of day it is. And a lot of that communication happens because the clock in our brain, it's called our suprachiasmatic nucleus, it oscillates And as it oscillates, it kind of changes its vibrations throughout the day. And so we kind of know sun is rising, sun is setting. And the mitochondria key in on those oscillations to adjust what they do for us. So one of the things that they, once they get that oscillatory signal that it's sunrise, that's when they start to make pregnenolone, right? They will make that master steroid hormone. And they also get, or they also get to decide, is Carrie in a state of threat, right? Am I experiencing any form of stressor where it's a stress to Carrie's survival? Is it even an emotional stressor? We do know from Martin Picard's research that an emotional stressor the night before will decrease mitochondrial function about 10 to 15% the next day. So mitochondria are perceiving our stress, our state of health, our state of well-being. And based on that, they're like, okay, I think we should ferry this much pregnenolone to cortisol and this much to fertility. And imagine what happens these days if mitochondria don't get the signal, if we're not converting that cholesterol to pregnenolone, we get a lot of tanked hormone levels, or if the mitochondria are perceiving massive amounts of stressors, they're going to be like, Carrie's not in a good state to make a baby and grow a baby right now. So we're really going to shut down fertility because we don't have the capacity to handle that right now. And the mitochondria are responsible for that, amongst so many other things. I mean, I can go on, Beth, right? Because they make signals to communicate gene expression, to communicate to the immune system, whether there's a threat, and the immune system needs to be activated. And so if mitochondria are copacetic, if they sense that all is well, which they do with the correct light signaling, as well as other frequencies, because they're very much pick up on non-native EMF frequencies in our environment. If the mitochondria can sense that they're in a state of peace, it's like, all is copacetic. Let's go back to business. But if they're perceiving a state of threat, that's when things really start to break down.
Can you talk about that? I think I've heard about the cell danger response, when the mitochondria sense a threat. Can you just speak a little bit to this concept of non-native EMFs and how that affects mitochondrial function?
Sure. So anytime there's an intracellular stressor, and that could be a pathogen, it could be a heavy metal, and it could be non-native EMFs that I'll talk in more detail about a little bit later. You get a nitric oxide production, excessive. It's the inducible nitric oxide, right? It's not the good nitric oxide that we can get to vasodilate our blood vessels, but it's the one that really is meant to kill a pathogen. What that nitric oxide does also is it can lodge itself into a part of the mitochondria where energy is produced. It's called step four of the electron transport chain, right? Cytochrome C oxidase. And when that nitric oxide is lodged in there, oxygen doesn't flow through. And oxygen's job in the mitochondria is to kind of flow in and combine at step four to make water, intracellular water. True hydration, in my opinion. And I know you probably talk to a lot of water people here, but if our mitochondria cannot make that water at step four, everything else goes awry. And so with that, then you're going to start to get, if nitric oxide is lodged in there, you're going to start to get excessive reactive oxygen species, which can also be called biophotons. And it's a signaling mechanism, right? It's like five alarm fire. And it really draws the attention of the immune system. It drives up what we would consider chronic inflammation. And all of these things really start to break down the ability of the mitochondria to just kind of be in control again. They have to revert to danger mode or survival mode or cell danger response. And so similarly to when there's an intracellular pathogen, we also see that with non-native EMFs, which is also known as radiation, or wireless radiation is a really broad term for most of these electromagnetic frequencies that are just not native to our world, right? They're human-created wavelengths. And so what happens is we get these frequencies that are confusing. And what these frequencies do, when they can penetrate right through us. So let's say I've got AirPods in. That wireless radiation is continuing to open calcium channels on my cell membrane. And those calcium, as you know, right, you get this, calcium's a messenger. We only want so much calcium to enter the cell at any given time because it kicks off various cascades. So it signals. When excessive calcium floods into that cell, it's like, whoa, there's a massive issue going on. And so excessive calcium forces the mitochondria to start to sequester it. So they got to kind of, again, separate from their normal behavior and sequester that calcium. And so if they can't sequester it all, you get the production of more nitric oxide. And what ultimately is like things like peroxynitrate and the hydroxyl radical, which are like these really, really nasty reactive oxygen species, which are synonymous with chronic inflammation, tissue damage. So that's what the mitochondria have to kind of deal with if they're dealing with a threat or a stressor and they're not in just their normal all is peaceful mode, where they can make water and they can make ATP and they can go about their normal signaling mechanisms.
Absolutely. Such important information. And then that's where, in part, the red light and near-infrared light comes in, because it will liberate the cytochrome C oxidase, you know, the fourth enzyme in the electron transport chain, kind of knocking the nitric oxide out so it can start functioning better again. So again, you know, it's the light that can kind of be the medicine for this. So let's move now to water and just the production of structured water within the mitochondria, within the cell, and how the structured water can then carry information, provide energy. Like, let's kind of move into that. You said something really cool at one point in an interview I listened to the other day about the structured water becoming like a superhighway for the transfer of information in the body. And I love that. And definitely along the lines of my thinking. So start with how light impacts the mitochondria's ability to manufacture water and the special kind of water that's found in the cell and how that transfers energy and information.
Such a cool topic. So mitochondria, as I alluded to before, right, at step four, they make water. Now, they make water as long as red and infrared light is present. Because like you said, that nitric oxide can jam up that step. But thankfully, red and infrared light will literally just kick nitric oxide out and allow for the electrons to flow again, the water to be made again, all as well. These days, the majority of us are really divorced from red and infrared frequencies because modern window glass will block it for energy efficiency and modern lighting has gotten rid of it for energy efficiency. But that just means that we literally, if we're indoors, we're not getting anywhere near the amount of red and infrared light that we would be getting if we were living like native humans were meant to. So with that being said, that means that we sometimes have to kind of do some support strategies, and you alluded to photobiomodulation. But when we can reestablish electron flow at step four, we're making intracellular water. And this water is no longer just basic H2O, right? The water in our bodies is nothing like the water in a glass. We see this water really swirling around. The H is then the O's are kind of free to do what I call a dance, right? You got these H2O molecules. It's like, I'm gonna dance with this person, then I'm gonna dance with that person, I'm gonna dance over here. And they kind of change partners all the time. But the water in our bodies, when it comes into contact with a biological surface, which is everywhere, the cell and the whole body is packed, right, with biological surfaces, hydrophilic surfaces, the water will reorganize itself. And it no longer is H2O. It's a ring, a hexagonal lattice. So the H's and the O's organize themselves into interlocking hexagons. H3O2 is more of what the chemical formula we're thinking. It is what the chemical formula is. And when water rearranges itself into H3O2, these beautiful hexagons of H's and O's, it actually no longer is neutral either. So water in a glass, if I were to measure the charge, the voltage, it would be neutral. Water in this state, in this hexagonal state, it's negatively charged. And it turns out that to become negatively charged, it kicks out a hydrogen, you know, so basically a proton, which lines itself up right next to the negative charge. So biological surface, negatively charged lattice, positive charge right here. That's a battery. That's charge separation, which is exactly why a battery that you use to power any electronic device has a positive end and a negative end. So really, I'm of the opinion that this water inside of our bodies is our main energy source. And it turns out we can charge this water battery. This water battery can become bigger with exposure to infrared light. Mm-hmm. Another reason, again, right, why potentially being indoors so much is depleting for our bodies, because we're not exposed to that wavelength that charges this water battery up. I mean, massively, right? Massively. And we're surrounded by these non-native EMFs that can shrink this and can really deplete this exclusion zone water inside of us. So it's a double-edged sword. We're probably around Wi-Fi all the time, and we're not going outside enough. And so this exclusion zone water, this true battery of potential energy around every surface, every protein in our body, gets depleted. Not to mention the mitochondrial dysfunction that can also prevent the water from being produced in the first place. But so many of my clinical strategies operate around optimizing water production and charging up this exclusion zone water battery. It's called exclusion zone water from Dr. Jerry Pollack's lab. Mm-hmm. And this exclusion zone water battery, if we can start to think of using therapies to help it, it's a game changer. It's such a game changer in terms of people feeling better.
I agree. Yeah. And I think it's really important for the audience to know just how powerful this battery is. You know, there's just been a lot of unexplained phenomena in the body that now finally is being explained by the energy that's coming from this charge separation. Like, you know, the heart really is not powerful enough to pump all the blood through the miles of capillary beds when, you know, the red blood cells have to kind of be jammed into these very little capillaries. And it's so there was kind of a mystery for so long to figure out, like, where's the energy coming from that's actually responsible for that? And it is the charged exclusion zone water that builds up on the inside of the vessels that's providing some of the energy for this. And there was a really cool experiment done where there were micro electrodes put in the negatively charged hexagonal zone and then that proton zone outside. And that charge separation was enough to kind of light an LED bulb for indefinitely. So it's incredible how much energy is there in the body because of the structured water. And now we've also learned that water holds information. It's almost like a supercomputer that can be imprinted with information signatures. And I think that's a big way that total body coordination is facilitated, is by the information in the water. And so talk a little bit about this information superhighway and how information propagates in the body.
Sure. This exclusion zone water network, it's structured into what physicists would refer to as a liquid crystalline state, a liquid crystal. So it's got properties of a liquid, still has a little fluidity, but the arrangement is pretty rigid, like you would find in a crystal of the H's and the O's. And this property of a liquid crystals have been known for a long time to be receivers and transmitters of all sorts of information, electromagnetic frequencies. I'm a firm believer, based on a lot of experiments I've read, that it's even like etheric-based energy, scalar energy, zero point, whatever you want to call it. Quantum field energy. So what you basically have in your body is you've got this network of water that's everywhere because it wraps every single surface from the cytoskeleton to all the proteins, all the extracellular space, like you alluded to, the blood, the lining of the blood vessels everywhere, every piece of fascia. And so this is an interconnected highway. If we needed to have lightning speed information transfer, that would be the ideal place, right? This interconnected space. And it just so happens that it's called exclusion zone water because it doesn't let things in. The only things that can really get into it are electrons, photons, and resonance and frequency as an antenna. So basically, again, like you've got this place where if I need to funnel electrons to someplace that's deficient, there are mitochondria that are in need of electrons, I can funnel them at the speed of light wherever they need to go. So it's a distributor of the bioelectricity, the electricity of our body that the mitochondria run on, that the membranes run on. And it's also a receiver of all of the frequency information in our environment. So, you know, we would know based on a lot of quantum experiments, we recognize that if I physically observe quantum particles or waves, they collapse, right? They collapse, they change their behavior. So there has to be a receiver of all of the frequencies that I'm bathing in right now. There has to be a receiver in my body that's picking that up and then kind of transducing that information throughout the body. It's our exclusion zone water network is doing that. It's picking up on the frequencies. And one of the things, including thoughts, including emotions and feelings, it's picking up on all of that. And one of the main areas that then it gets that kind of gets that information gets funneled to is the mitochondria, because the mitochondria will adjust their behavior then based on the frequency information in my environment. So it's like a silent observer of all of the frequencies that I'm being bathed in right now, which then means that the frequencies that I surround myself with really matter, because I'm picking up on them all the time and subconsciously making a judgment of, is this an area of threat or is this an area of safety? And so just being aware of the frequencies in our environment really, really affects our health, our ability to make energy, and our ability to heal.
Absolutely. So true. And what are some of the tips that you would say would be our audience could kind of adopt for supporting mitochondrial health and mitochondrial water production? You've mentioned being out in the sun, but anything else that you can?
Sure. So sunlight is my foundation, especially morning sunlight. I also like people to be aware of creating a true nighttime, right? So blocking the artificial light at night. That's another key right there. And then after that, the mitochondria are, they love supplemental light in the form of a red light therapy panel. So red light therapy, I will recommend to my clients. Sauna therapy, I recommend it. And it doesn't have to be the sauna where one gets in and has to have massive rivers of sweat all over their body. Because that water inside of our body really absorbs kind of the heat wavelengths of light, that you can just be in there for a little, what I call an easy recharge. So a 5 or a 10 minute little hit of that heat can be very supportive. I also like earthing and grounding, you know, touching the earth, because that will build exclusions on water and it'll pull electrons into the body. So again, if my mitochondria sense electron deficiency, that's a stressful state. So I'm gonna pull electrons in through earthing and grounding to kind of reestablish energy production where it's needed, to assist with energy production where it's needed. Time in nature is, I prescribed more time in nature than ever, because nature is full of energy, you know, like calming frequencies. It takes us out of kind of these chaotic frequencies we get, whether the chaotic frequency is coming from a stressed out coworker or whether the chaotic frequency is coming from my cell phone next to me. So being in nature kind of allows us to get what I call a resonance reset. We tune all of our little receivers in our body back to like this state of calm. And so the sounds of birds, the sounds of water, the sounds of leaves rustling in the trees, we pick up on all of that. And it creates more structured water, but it also creates this sense of for mitochondria of peace. It's a key habit I've had for many people, even who are trying to conceive, to go into nature. It's amazing how resetting that is beyond just, you know, this kind of, oh, yeah, nature, I feel good in nature. It's like, no, literally, there's probably 100 things happening in your body right now because you took the time to go into nature. You know, that's a few right there that I love to give people as a starting point.
Awesome. And then I always also recommend that people turn their Wi-Fi off at night, have it on a timer so they don't forget. I have like personally shown massive differences in my sleep quality on nights where I've forgotten to turn Wi-Fi off, for example, on my Oura Ring. And do you have any other recommendations of like shielding devices or you know, these kind of things that might mitigate some of the kind of electromagnetic pollution that we're exposed to on a daily basis?
Yeah, a couple of ideas with that with clients is, number one, the true impact of how much they affect those calcium channels has to do with their proximity to us. Yeah. So, you know, I really encourage people to take the EMF emitting devices off of their bodies, right?
100% agree. I am so not a fan of like the Apple Watches and the EarPods and all of that.
Exactly. And so if you have a cell phone with you, place it far, far away, right? Just get yourself away from the device itself. Then hardwire, if at all possible. So, you know, my workstation, you know, I'm old school. I've got a hardwired keyboard and mouse, and does it look ugly? My monitor, do the cords sometimes get tangled as I'm shuffling things? Yes. But when I take my little EMF meter and I like put it around me, am I exposed to any EMFs? No, right? So hardwiring when at all possible. And if we can't hardwire, we really My favorite mitigation strategy for like an office worker is actually molecular hydrogen and consuming plenty of spring mineral water, taking time to then go outside for little breaks, and even do things like humming, some soothing sounds and soothing strategies to the body to put it in a sense of peace, even if it is in a more chaotic environment. So while I feel like I've tried a lot of harmonizing devices, I feel the potential is there. There's not one that I can just be gung-ho and recommend. I would rather people be aware of their proximity to their technology, the amount of time they use it, and the fact that they have to go back outside into nature to kind of reset the chaos that these devices can cause the body.
Absolutely agree. Yeah, well, just to kind of wrap it up here, any important thoughts that you feel like you'd still like to communicate?
Do you know, there's one healing technique that involves water that I would love to share, because I feel like that water, it receives and structures itself based on any thought or any emotion. And so I highly encourage people to work on what I call their quantum mindset, which is this idea of you know, with intention, with emotion, the body can kind of be guided into coherence. And that's the quantum physics or the biophysics of what a healthy body is. It's coherent. Every part is in coordination with all other parts, but can still be free to do what it needs to do in the moment to adapt to health. And so we can bring our body back into that state of coherence through the water. And so I like for people to actually, I'll have them draw, this is inspired by Joe Dispenza. I'll have them take a piece of paper, because people on a long healing journey, as you know, a chronic illness journey is nothing to poo-poo. Decades sometimes for people. But what I feel sometimes happens is people get kind of stuck in searching for the next thing to heal them and not recognizing the body's self-healing capabilities. And so I want them to tap into that. But the body can only heal and come into coherence if it has guidance, if it knows, if it really truly knows your intention and who you want to be. And so I will have them at the top of a piece of paper. I'll have them draw a little sketch, right? A star, a heart, a tree, a flower, something where when they close their eyes, they can picture it. They can see it exactly. And then underneath it, I have them write who they are as their most thriving self in the present tense. I am able to meet every demand that my day puts on me. I am able to run 2 miles with no pain and I enjoy it. I'm able to laugh freely and I laugh all the time. Like they spend as much time as they want writing out who that thriving version of themselves is. And then below that, they list how they feel. They embody that person and they sit with how they feel as that person and they write the emotions they're experiencing. So are they experiencing gratitude, joy, unconditional love, blessed, just beyond grateful? What are they feeling? And then I have them set that paper out and always place their water glass on top of it. Because what I'm doing is I'm having those intentions and emotions. They're imbibing it. They're sending it into their water every single time. So every time they drink a sip of water, they're sending those coherent frequencies and that intention into their body for them then to communicate wirelessly and just this frequency information all throughout their network. So the body knows where it's going, knows the state that it wants to be. And that's where I really believe that intention comes into play.
That is beautiful, Carrie. What a great practice. And then just as our final send-off here, considering what you have shared with us today, what do you think is the most empowering take-home message about health and healing?
I think that the body is designed to thrive. It's always looking to thrive. So what we see as disease is just the body trying to get back to homeostasis. And if we provide it with a couple of key inputs, including this idea of love and peace and calm and coherence, it wants to thrive for us. And so my foundation is always to reconnect with nature in as many ways you possibly can, because there's nothing like being in a true nature setting that gives the body, through light, through earthing, and through the frequencies, all the signals that it needs to heal.
Oh, beautiful. Well, this has been an incredible pleasure, and I just enjoy talking with you so much. So thanks for joining us, Carrie Bennett.
Thank you, Beth. I had a great time chatting with you.
So Carrie, how can people get in touch with you, and how can they learn more about your work?
You know, Beth, the best place to get into this information and what I'm teaching and the courses I'm offering is through my Instagram page. I put out more information on this pretty much every single day. I'll do a post. So if this inspires you, just go there. You'll see that 1,000 posts you can deep dive into. And then in my link tree in my bio is where I really list my upcoming courses, my different webinars and workshops, including my foundations course, my quantum foundations course, which will take you through all of this and how to apply it if you're interested in, you know, learning exactly what to do using this information.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us today with Carrie Bennett on the Science of Healing Summit.